Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and mental health consultant. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Hank. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well, and I'm excited to have you in the studio with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you join me. I know how much you look forward to it.
Likewise.
And I'm looking forward to speaking with our guest today also. I have a special guest, Dr. Stephen Pollock, in the studio with us today. And we're going to be talking about pets and the mental health benefits of having pets in our life today, which I think is something that many of us can relate to because over half of the population has a pet in their life in some way and at some time. But this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we're doing things a little differently this week. We're not going to be taking phone calls. We're going to just have the conversation in studio because I think we have a lot to cover. And so we're going to close down the phones, but we hope that you will be part of the conversation through our webpage, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can log on and post comments or feedback, listen to previous shows. You can also find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, where you can like our page and also hear about shows that are coming up or post your comments about today's show. And you can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or you can always find more information at kcbx.org, which is our main website. And you can find previous shows there under the News and Talk tab. And also you can listen to shows on demand through the Listen Live tab. And the Listen Live tab connects you to On Demand, and then you can find all of our shows that are up there for a week. How'd I do?
That's good. When you click on Listen Live, it'll immediately start playing what's on the air right now, our live stream, and then there's another tab right up at the top that says On Demand, and you find the show of your choice, in this case, The Reluctant Therapist, and you can click on it anytime this week. So when the show gets replaced next week with a new show, that's what becomes the On Demand.
And then everything's in the archives for
forever,
for years to come.
Right.
So you can always stay connected. And one of the things I love about this show is the opportunity to talk about a diverse amount of subjects. We tend to talk about anxiety or depression or raising children or love in our lives or growing older. And today we're going to talk about one of the often unspoken members of our family, which are the pets in our lives, and how they become such an integral part of our experience that they are like members of our family. And I have been a pet owner all of my life. We've always been cat people. I think there tends to be a personality associated maybe with pet ownership. I don't know, but I grew up in a cat family. My father always had cats, and so we always had cats. And I don't remember a time in my life that there weren't some furry friends living in my house. And over the years, of course, with all the joy of having the pets and the love and the just seeing all the cute things they do, because I think the number one viral videos on YouTube are cat videos. So there is something to watching them that is enjoyable and reduces stress. But along with that also is the inevitable heartache that comes with pets and pet ownership, because we are responsible for their health and well-being as it should be. And so along with that, we have to make decisions. And oftentimes they're really tough decisions. And so today I was hoping that we could talk about not only the joys and benefits of pet ownership and the mental health benefits of having pets in our life, but also to address some of the issues regarding end-of-life care for pets and how we can go about keeping our pets comfortable or knowing when it's time to let them go. And because I'm not an expert in any of those fields, I've invited Dr. Stephen Pollock from the VCA South County Animal Hospital to be my expert guest today and to offer not only his professional experience in the field, but also his personal experience with pets and animals, because he is someone who has loved animals all of his life and has had quite a few animals in his private life. So I'm hoping he'll share both the personal and the professional. Good morning, Dr. Pollock.
Good morning, Elizabeth. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, I appreciate you coming in, and I know I'm the reluctant therapist, and quite often my guests are the reluctant guests. But I appreciate you taking the time and the courage to come in and tell your story. And I was hoping you start off by telling us a little bit about your path to becoming a veterinarian at VCA.
Well, I think like a lot of my clients that come in, especially when there's kids involved, I get sort of proudly told a lot of times that the children want to become veterinarians. And I guess I was probably one of those. I grew up in a rural area in the Midwest, in Illinois, and we had pets. We had sheep, we had horses, we had dogs, cats, and there was a lot of wild animals too. And I was always collecting rabbits, and we had a barns and chicken house, and that I sort of took over as my hospital. And so it started very young. It competed a little bit with sports in my life, but I think that that's when the seed first started. And I was encouraged by my parents. They said, you should be a veterinarian when you grow up. And as time went on, I think that, the world opened up and a lot of other things came in. So I grew up at the time of Vietnam, was in the service. When you get close to getting out, everybody says, well, what are you going to do when you get out? So I sort of fell back on my old, well, I'm going to be a veterinarian. And everybody sort of laughed and, they don't really believe you're going to do that. And so it was a good motivator for me. And so basically that's what I did. That's when my schooling started. Took a lot of twists and turns through quite a few states and more years than it should have. But life has a way of intervening. So I initially graduated from Washington State University.
Was that before you were in the service or after?
After. I started school in California. And more that you would know about, but these little life crises come upon you. They're not invited; they just show up, and things happen, and you reevaluate everything. And anyway, I ended up in sort of northern Idaho, and with a big family, and built a cabin in the woods, and that worked out great for a while. And then another 7 years went by, and another crisis came along, and just decided that this isn't going anywhere. And so I finished my schooling at the University of Idaho and went on to veterinary school at Washington State University. And from there, looked all over the Northwest and eventually settled in Northern California to start practice. And because the Central Coast was a place that I'd been through and liked, I eventually came here. And I've been at... been there for almost 20 years now.
And I've known you all those 20 years.
You have.
You first came to town. So I'm curious, through all the years you were kind of going through the schooling, through school and getting trained to be a veterinarian, did you still have a lot of animals in your life? I mean, were you still always passionate about animals all the way through, or was becoming a veterinarian more of a career path at some point? I mean, was it still the love?
I think at that stage, I didn't have a lot of animals. I had five kids going through school.
Which has its own version of pet.
It did. And between school and trying to work full time and manage that, I think at that time one dog, I think, was about it. Mm-hmm. The animals sort of came later. As the kids grew up and the animals sort of came in.
They start filling in the voids when the kids leave.
Yes.
Which we tend to notice. I've noticed quite a bit with my peers. As their children are leaving, they tend to be adopting small furries that they carry around in little front packs. And there mm-hmm. there does seem to be that void that animals fill. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, joined in the studio today by Dr. Stephen Pollack, who is the veterinarian at VCA South County Animal Hospital, where I take my pets. We're not taking phone calls today. We're talking about the mental health benefits of pet ownership and also some of the trials and heartaches that might come along with having pets in our lives. And Hank is in the studio with me today. Hank, are you a pet lover?
I am a pet lover, yes. We had a dog as I was growing up that was kind of an outside dog, and I didn't develop an especially close bond with him. I fed him and I picked up after him, but we, I don't know, when I met my wife, she had a older yellow lab, and that's when the bond came in. And, you know, when he died, he lived to be about 15 years old. And when he died, that was tough. That was, you know, that was harder for me than the death of some people that I know. And it was just devastating. And so now we've got another... we got another yellow lab to replace Bud, and we got another guy from the shelter to be Bonnie's friend. So now we have two dogs, and now they're getting older, and I feel the same apprehension and dread coming on, because we know in the next few years the inevitable is going to happen. And it's just so sad that, you know, something that you become so close to is with you 12, 13, 14 years, and that's it.
And it doesn't feel like enough time.
No,
ever.
Not at all. I mean, to me, Bonnie's still a puppy. We got her, you know, when she was like 14 pounds, and now she's 110 and moving slow and arthritic. And it's just sad to see them decline so fast.
It is painful. And also, yep. You remember them being just little pups so soon or so young. So I'm curious, Dr. Pollack, what are some of the things about being a veterinarian that you most enjoy?
Well... that's a good question. I think I enjoy most of it. I really enjoy my interaction with the people, because to me, especially over the, a lot of times when you first start, it's the medicine and the science is the real draw. But the longer you go on, you realize what the part that you get the most from is the becoming part of a team that's, you know, these pets are our family members now. Mm-hmm. You know, that's changed a lot. As Hank said, you know, that it used to be that dogs lived in the backyard. You know, they were fed, but you know, you didn't have that real close personal relationship for the most part. And that doesn't happen too much anymore.
So there's been a change.
There has been a change. Yeah, the pets now are playing a much bigger role. I can remember when I was in veterinary school, there was a Chinese veterinarian that came to study Western anesthesiology. And I had him over to dinner to my house one time, and he looked at my little dog and said, you know, we eat those in China. And it just sort of brought home that, you know, how things are changing for us too, because, I mean, we're a long way from that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, dogs were still outside. Cats were mousers. And now they're as much a part of family often as children are. Mm-hmm. And so the value that's placed on the relationship is so huge now. And to be part of that is very fulfilling.
So for you to be almost part of the family system, when people come in and they're counting on you to have the best information or to guide them with how to care for their pet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm curious too, because I have noticed, and I think we've all noticed, the change in how we value our pets over the last probably 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of been a slow metamorphosis, and looking at all the different, you know, pet specialty stores and things that are available. And I wonder if it is equated at all to the pace and complexity of our lives, or, you know, even though we have all this technology, we still have such high rates of anxiety and depression, and people feel isolated and alienated. Because if you're at home, even if you're on a computer in a chat room, you're still alone. And I wonder if pets have kind of filled that space where a lot of the disconnect or pace of life has taken over.
I think pets have definitely done that. I don't think there's any question. You know, it's the relationships that people have with their pets. You know, I've had to humanely euthanize suffering pets that, you know, people have said, I need to go too. You know, they
actually were feeling,
yeah,
that they were done.
Yeah. So it's you know, it's heartbreaking.
It is. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm joined by my guest, Dr. Stephen Pollack from VCA South County Animal Hospital. Today we're talking about mental health and pet ownership. And it's interesting, you know, when we talk about mental health and pets, I think many people realize that some of the obvious benefits are stress relief, having just that other warm body in the house. We don't feel so alone or isolated. But they've also been able to test levels, triglyceride levels decrease when you own a pet. Your cholesterol levels can decrease when you have a pet. Blood pressure decreases. I mean, the actual tangible medical changes when you have the pet in the house. And also, similar to people who are married, people who are very vested in their pets tend to live longer. They have less stays in the hospital. And when they do stay in the hospital, it's for a less amount of time. And I think having this pet partner, someone that you're very, another being that you're vested in, gives us a reason to live, gives us a sense of purpose and meaning, and the desire to stay around a while longer, which is a reminder that so much of our mental health is involved in our attitude about our lives. You know, we think that it's kind of a crapshoot that we just have so long to live and you're either going to be healthy or not healthy and you can't do anything about it. But something like seeing these physical changes in people when they're involved with a pet in their life and realizing that you can improve the quality of your life just by caring for a pet, is proof that our attitude really is the huge driving force in the quality of our lives. And is if our mental health is suffering, if we are feeling anxious or depressed or alienated, that maybe adopting an animal into your life is something that would really help ground you and settle. I mean, I also think for children, the health benefits of having a pet, not only learning responsibility, having to pick up after the pet, feed them, take them for a walk, you know, petting them, spending time with them, throwing the ball, it gets the kids outside, gives them a little exercise. But I also understand that for kids with autism or learning disabilities or other mental health struggles, ADHD, that having pets in their life helps to stabilize those issues. Are you familiar at all with that?
There are a lot of programs now. Back in about the 70s, there were a group of human doctor, veterinarian that got together and talked about this bond between people and their pets. And there really was nothing that was real official or organized about it. It was just, you know, it was there. But so they started an organization called the Delta Society. Dr. Leo Bustad, who was the dean of the veterinary school at Washington State University, was I think he was the first president. And they called that the People-Pet Partnership. And it's grown to be just a huge factor now. The name has changed to become People-Pet Partners. And they have a national program for therapy animals in all sorts of ways for you know, everything from, you know, guide dogs mm-hmm. for the blind, people are hearing impaired, children with autism, people come and I see animals all the time that have to be certified for nursing home and care home visits. A lot of people do that now. So it's all over, and I think it's a growing trend.
So do you think the animal assistance programs then might be even a career option where when you were growing up to work with animals, you became a veterinarian, but has the field of working with animals expanded then because of our relationship with pets?
Yeah, I think of course, a lot of it is volunteer. Mm-hmm. People do that as volunteer work, but there are instructors and trainers and people that are involved now in the field that, yes, they have a career.
It's fascinating because my younger daughter is very loves pets and loves animals, and she's had her cat Little Dude since she was probably 5 or 6 years old, and it was wonderful to watch the bond between them because she went and adopted him and chose him, and he chose her. Really, it was amazing to see how he really connected to her, and she read the entire cat encyclopedia and, you know, trained him over the years to do tricks, and the connection between them is phenomenal, and it inspired her to want to do work at the Humane Society and now go on and do some zoo and animal conservation or animal programs in her career, just all from this involvement with this one little kitten that she fell in love with when she was 5. And I find that fascinating. And I also have seen kind of the stabilizing force of having this cat, you know, going through all the stressors of school and friendships and disappointments. And then every night when you climb into bed and she climbs into bed, he's right there by her side, never, you know, failing to keep her company. And so I wonder how you've seen, you know, those relationships in your clients developed, you know, any stories of children and animals or families and animals that really touched you?
Yeah, I don't. You know, most of the time I don't. The children that go off and things. We sort of lose track of that, and so I guess I don't really have an answer for that one. I guess the ones that are probably the most poignant for me, though, are the children that do go off to college and their pets that they grew up with that played such a big role in their lives. You know, are aging a lot faster than they are, and often they're away at school, and you know the animals have kind of reached their lifespan, and they have a terminal illness, and it's sort of the parents then that are looking after them and having to make the decisions about, well, do we call her at school because she's going to want to come home?
Yes,
you know, and so those are the kind of conversations that usually come up. You know, what to do in those situations.
So you're doing a lot of mental health work.
Yeah.
Unintended mental health work.
Unintended, yeah.
Because I imagine that will be part of, you know, our future as she goes off to college next year and little dude is getting older, that those conversations are going to come up. And I guess I just want to go to that conversation about how do we, if we've invested all this time, this years and love into this animal and the animal has just given us unconditional love back, I think one of the reasons we are so bonded in our animal partnerships is because they do need us to survive, you know, to get fed and sheltered and medical care. And so I think whenever we care for something that is more vulnerable than us, I don't know if that bond for some reason becomes greater. I just know that I feel that sense with my cats, that they are depending on me. And so I feel that they're much more vulnerable. But how... And from your position as a veterinarian, because you have the tools to extend life, you know, how do you know when it's time to let a pet go?
Well, you know, there's no one answer to that. But there have people that have addressed that before. And one of those, Dr. Alice Villalobos, is an oncologist who treated cancer and developed a quality of life scale that's that, you know, takes into account all the major things to consider, gives it a point score, and then you look at that to see, because I'm just truly amazed that people are, it is the thing that is most brought up, I think, and when we get to these points in life, that nobody wants their pets to suffer. Everybody, they're part of their family, and it's the last thing they want to do. So we spend a lot of time, you know, figuring out, well, where are they and when is the right time. And I think that this quality of life scale can really help. It is based on whether there's pain involved, whether they're able to get adequate nutrition, whether they can move around, whether they can interact, whether they have more good days than bad days. So you can assign a score to all these and at least come up with some rationale for it that's objective. And then you know, you talk about it. And hopefully you start long enough that people are getting ready, because it's not a decision you want to make, you know, at the spur of the moment.
No, definitely not standing in the office, which I've experienced many times over my life of having pets, that you find yourself trying to make a decision when you're overcome with emotion. So is the scale something that people, that you have the clients do, or is it something that the veterinarian goes through himself? I mean, how do you, because I've never heard of the scale, you know.
I guess it can work both ways. I've given it to people, send it to people by email, or we just talk about it in the exam room and go through it and all those factors, and you know, everybody's different. You know, there are some that are ready to let go at the first sign because they are so afraid of letting things go too far, and surprisingly that often is that occurs more often because you know, most people are really care. It's not like they're going too far and these animals should have been, you know, euthanized a long time ago. So it's an important part of the life cycle. And I guess when we go back to the children too that have grown up with their pets, it's one of the things that I think one of the often untalked about is sort of losing the first pet too, because it's going to happen to everybody. You know, lifespan isn't that long. Dogs and cats live from an average of, you know, 8 or 9, 10 years up to, you know, for the longer lived ones, maybe 17, 18. So that goes by really fast. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, loss is part of life too. And so we try to look at it. I used to, one of the books that I remember with my children is The 10th Good Thing About Barney.
I don't know that.
I think it was Judith Viorst's book that he was a cat that died, and it was one of the all the things that made a list of, you know, all the good things about him. And so that's one of the things I think that children learn that is a really important part of life.
And I agree, because, and I talk about on the show, that we don't talk about death and dying as a society, even for humans, let alone for our pets, because we're afraid we're going to somehow catch it. Mm-hmm. If we talk mm-hmm. about it, we'll bring upon our own demise more quickly. I think we have kind of a jinx feeling about talking about death and dying. And I think it, in turn, is a huge disservice to our children, because it is such a shock for them when someone they love or their pet does die. And I think if we could normalize the life cycle, as you say, that kind of circle of life, you know, Lion King story, that things go on and that they have a season, that would be really healthy. And so I know in our family, when one of our cats has died, everyone says goodbye to the cat, and we all are part of burying the cat in our backyard at some point. And the kids, you know, make a sign or are part of that whole process. And I have to say that with both my children, they were much more calm with being with the animals when they were dead than actually I was. I felt I was much more anxious being with the dead animal. The two girls, and maybe it's because we normalized, I'm not sure, but have you noticed that children tend to, if you don't scare them, children tend to have an innate understanding of that cycle. Have you noticed that?
I think that's true.
Yeah, that there's some more, because you had five children, so I'm wondering how your pet death experience was with them. Were they more accepting, or just was it more of a natural part of their life?
I think they are more accepting, and I think it was part of life. It was just, you know, they, in some ways, they're maybe more connected to life than as we get older and a little bit more isolated sometimes. And so it sort of became a natural part. And they would grieve, of course, just like anybody would, but able to move on and seemed to do it quite well.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm joined today by Dr. Stephen Pollack from VCA South County Animal Hospital in Arroyo Grande, and we're talking about pets and mental health and well-being, and how can we, as pet owners who have these tight bonds with our animals, know when it's okay to let our pets go, or how much we should intervene, because with all of the advances in the medical fields now, I think as a veterinarian, you have a lot more options and things that you can offer to people. To extend the life of pets. And so I'm curious about, you know, how do we know when it's okay to stop intervening, or how many things should we continue doing? How much money and time? Because, I'm trying to be sensitive to that, because if this is a member of your family, I would imagine that a lot of people come in and say, I don't care what the cost is, I'm going to continue wanting to care for this animal. But at some point, especially if you're elderly and you're on a fixed income, I think that would be a dilemma. What do you think, Hank?
Well, yeah, we went through that with our first yellow lab, Bud. He was 15 years old and developing. He had seizures, and the vet gave us our choices, you know, not wanting to put any pressure on us, but giving us all the options, including euthanizing all the way up to flying him up to Stanford for an MRI to extend his life. But the bottom line is, you have a 15-year-old dog that has a 15-year-old, you know, he's living on borrowed time as it is. So how much expense do you want for a limited amount of time? And, you know, do you want to spend thousands of dollars to extend his life by 2 months, or at least be, we weren't sure the with the diagnosis that he had. They were unable to tell if it was epilepsy or something else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that point, does it even matter if he's living a generally happy life?
And I think for me, a lot is the guilt of, you know, did I go sure. far enough, or did I, should I have spent another $500?
Yeah.
So we're going to come back in a moment and ask Dr. Pollack, what are the right answers to this dilemma of knowing end-of-life care for our pets? And this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, joined today by Dr. Stephen Pollack from VCA South County Animal Hospital in Aurora Grande. We're not doing phone calls today because we're kind of keeping the conversation in-house because there's a lot of things I wanted to cover when it came to pets and pet ownership and pets and our mental health and well-being. And we had talked a bit earlier about all the benefits to having a pet in your house, the lowered blood pressure, lowering cholesterol levels, lowering triglyceride levels, alleviating feelings of loneliness and isolation and depression and anxiety in everyone in the family, from young children to the elderly. We see huge emotional lifts when pets are introduced into their lives. Pets also increase opportunity to get more exercise, which is good for our physical health, or spending time outdoors. And there's a socialization piece. You know, for a lot of people, going to dog parks or, you know, running their dog on the beach gives you an opportunity to meet other people. And one of the things we talk about quite often on the show is there's a lot of people out in our community who feel really alone and don't feel connected to a group. But if you have a pet and you're running your dog or playing catch at the dog park, you're going to meet a lot of like-minded people. I think it's a great opportunity to maybe get to know someone else because you already share this love of pets. And then we're also talking about some of the heartache that comes along with pet ownership, and that's the inevitable end of life for our pets. And how do we know when it's time to let them go? We talked a little bit about the scale. What's the name of the...
It's just called the quality of life scale.
The quality of life scale that can be applied to kind of sense, you know, if your pet's quality of life is such that it's time to let them go or time to intervene. But I'm also curious about the advances that you've seen in veterinary medicine in the last 20 years. It seems like now you could extend your pet's life if you had enough money. And so if you're someone who is vested in this pet, but you're facing thousands of dollars in the possibility of keeping them going, how do you know, you know, how much money you should spend? And as a veterinarian, you see someone who might be on a fixed income or have kids in college, but they also have this pet, and you know there's things you could do. Do you grapple with that at all?
Yeah, I think that's something that all veterinarians grapple with. It's a reality of life, and it's something we deal with probably every day. But one of the freedoms that we have in veterinary medicine is that the quality of life, we have the freedom to let them go, you know, unlike people in most states, in most cases. You know, we all know how people at the end of life, you know, are maybe not treated, but we can't choose to end the life.
No.
But with pets we can. We view it differently, and it doesn't come from a desire that they're not there anymore. It comes from the desire that we want to end any suffering that they have. We don't want them to have to sort of tough it out to the end, and so we can make that choice. I guess the answer to the question, though, really comes from honest communication. You know, because some things maybe we can extend life, but are we extending quality of life a long time? And so if we have that conversation and we can really extend life and quality of life, and it can be meaningful, we want to have that honest communication with the client that, yes, we can do this. It's, you know, you're not going to spend a lot of money and then, you know, they're going to be here for just a week and then they're going to be right back where they were and we're going to still have to make the decision. So you have to feel comfortable with your veterinarian to say, you know, to talk about those things and how much you can afford to treat.
But so, I wonder, though, when you're emotional, you don't feel like you can put a financial number on your pets. And so I'm just curious, you know, do you feel compelled to say, we'll fly up to Stanford with a pet if you know that there's someone on a fixed income or, you know, you've known these people for a long time? Do you find yourself holding back options?
No. I think you let people know what the options are and, you know, roughly what it might cost and what maybe you could expect as an outcome. That's all got to be part of this conversation. But at the same time, you know, you have to be realistic and be able to talk about what they can do too. You know, you never know for sure. I mean, people, there's a lot of options that don't come up, you know, that people don't tell you that, well, I could go to my rich uncle who really loves animals and he's always said he would help me, you know. Mm-hmm. That may come up, but that's not usually the norm. So what we want to do is try to be as realistic as we can. I mean, there's a lot of ways to treat things. You don't always have to go for the latest and greatest medical therapy. Sometimes it's, you know, try to make them comfortable, try to keep them happy. You know, that's really a fair option too.
So I'm curious, over the last 20 years, what are some of the medical breakthroughs in treating pets that you found have really improved the quality of life for pets? That are some interventions that you've found have been really effective?
Well, some of the things are, you know, very mundane. They're things like, you know, my dog has allergies. He scratches all the time. He has no hair. He keeps us awake at night. He looks terrible. He's miserable, you know, and for years our options have been, you know, we'll give him steroids and it'll make him comfortable. But, you know, he'll end up with diabetes or he'll have liver disease or, you know, something else. And now there are some newer drugs available that can treat those things that can make them comfortable and, you know, you won't take your life savings and they'll be happy, you know. So things like that are, you know, they're not, you know, it's not like a heart transplant or anything like that, but it makes a huge difference.
And then when it comes to bigger, more expensive items, you know, a $5,000 surgery or I can't even think. When it's interesting you brought the steroids and diabetes because little dude, you and I have been treating him for steroid-induced diabetes. And that was a huge expense mm-hmm. that we took on because he's still young enough to be healthy. But it's also the impact to our family. And you can't just go on vacation if your cat needs two shots a day. And so, you know, part of me that's, again, trying to be sensitive because I am a pet lover. But at the same time, also, our quality of life as a family, when all of a sudden your pet needs shots and pills and a lot of maintenance, and so you can't leave your home anymore because you have a cat. Have we gone too far with this? I don't know. I don't even, you know, I guess it just depends on how much the pet is a part of your life. But I wonder at some point if your quality of life suffers because you've now vested so much in the animal that you've lost sight of.
Like all of life, there's a balance. And you know, our quality of life sometimes does suffer. You know, I know that even with in my own situation, it's really hard to get away because, you know, I have there's an old horse that stumbles around my property that needs constant care, and I have you know, a parrot that needs to be taken care of who doesn't like anybody else, and you know, besides dogs and cats and things. So, but it's a choice we make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody tells us that we have to have pets, so we know that we get things out of them. And I think, as you say, you know, the pendulum is sort of swung now, and pets are part of our families. And I mean, I guess you could be talking about children and saying, "God, let's get them out of the house," and you know, so I'm going to have a life again and things. But they bring us a lot.
They do, and it is interesting because I think we have to be much more careful about our commitment to adopting animals when they're going to live for 15, 20 years. I mean, Hank was saying, you know, they're gone so soon, but I think in some cases if the pets, you know, are sick or need a lot of maintenance, or we do have pets with very interesting personalities that might not like anyone else, and so you can't leave. And I think people sometimes don't think about the long-term impact of pet adoption. You know, their kids are young and they, oh, let's get a puppy and wouldn't that be fun? But the puppy becomes a dog and the kids get busy with sports and no one wants to take care of the dog. And, you know, that's a, kind of the another piece of the whole mental health and well-being of, you know, what pets bring to our life. But I think quite often we don't think about the long-term care of the pets and the impact that if they do become sick and elderly and frail, that we will have to change our lifestyle to care for these pets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could say the same just for myself. You know, I adopted a parrot and
that's, they live longer than we do.
That was 30 years ago. I wasn't thinking 30 years ahead.
Yeah. Well, and so do you ever give advice or guidance to families that are thinking of adopting an animal? I mean, do you have any guidelines or things that people should think about before they choose what kind of dog or a cat or a mouse that they should adopt?
Well, absolutely. I think that you know, a lot of times it's people with children. They want to be sure that they bring an animal in that's going to be safe. Sometimes people come in with very small children and think they should adopt a very small dog, which is generally not a good idea because small children are you know, they haven't reached that age yet where their reason is developed. And so a nice, big, happy dog that likes any kind of attention and falling on and pulling and stuff is a great dog for a family like that. So, yeah, we do have those conversations a lot. And which breeds are, you know, more trouble-free? Which ones need less grooming? Are they less likely to have these kind of problems or those kind of problems? Would you be better off with a dog or a cat? You know, there's a lot of things. Cats are independent. They take care of themselves. You leave their litter box there and their food and water, and they look after themselves. You do that with your dog, and you're going to have a lot of mess to clean up, you know. So it all goes back to your lifestyle and you know, what you're drawn to, I guess.
So are there certain dogs that you have a preference for when it comes to families?
No. I would say, well, if you are a you have young kids and you want a dog that's adaptable to a lot of situations. The one that I got originally when my kids were young was a golden retriever. In fact, I was just looking through some pictures, and there was one of him dressed up, and he had a baseball uniform on. He had a baseball hat. He had a glove on his hand with a ball in it. And that was the kind of thing that and he thought that was great.
Yeah, he's
getting
trained.
Yeah. So yeah, there are those labs or another breed that's usually pretty good that way. Whereas, you know, I've had also those that think that, you know, it would be something that they can carry around and things, but often that isn't work out so well because a lot of those smaller dogs don't like that kind of attention, and so it may not be appropriate.
So that would be something that'd be appropriate to discuss with your veterinarian before adopting a pet to kind of check the fit, maybe?
Absolutely.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm joined today in the studio by Dr. Stephen Pollock, who is a veterinarian at VCA South County Animal Hospital in Rio Grande. Hank is here in the studio, and we're talking about pets and mental health benefits of pet ownership and also some of the responsibilities that come along with having pets. Because as much as, you know, pets bring to us joy and happiness and a companionship, we talked a little bit about the socialization. And when we're feeling isolated, it's a great opportunity to get out and meet other people. I've never seen anyone get more attention than someone walking a dog on the beach, right? Everyone wants to stop and talk to the dog. So even if you don't own a dog and you want to meet other people, maybe borrow a friend's dog to take for a walk, and you'll have tons of people stop and keep you company. Or want to find out about your pet, make sure you know about your pets. You have something to say. Having pets gives us a sense of purpose. And I think, you know, when the kids move out of the house and you know, you're faced that empty nest, or your spouse passes away, your friends are gone, having this sense of purpose, someone to get up for, someone who needs some food or some exercise or some attention is really important. pets help our children learn responsibility. As Dr. Pollack was saying, pets are a great opportunity for children to understand the cycle of life. And that is, you know, we go through life, animals age and change and slow down, and we have to change the way we are with our animals and be more tender and patient with them, and that eventually they will die. And how we go through the ceremony of death is really important with our animals, because we're going to go through the ceremony of death with adults in our life, with humans in our lives. So pets are a great opportunity to normalize life's passings in a way that help our children to develop resilience when faced with death in other parts of their life. And Dr. Pollack was also talking about, you know, how long do we intervene and keep our animals with us? And what about at the end of life when it is time to let them go? You know, what are some of the options? Because I know for me, taking my pets to the vet to be put to sleep has been one of the most painful things, because I hate the idea that their last moments of life are being terrified, because they never like going to the vet. So how do we handle that?
I think that, of course, I guess I would be no different, that I would like to have my pets, when they get old, to all die in their sleep at home.
Absolutely. Right? And they never seem to.
And they never do, because you know, they don't live that long. People die of catastrophic things, heart attacks and strokes and things, because we've lived a long time. Our bodies get old, our vessels get clogged. Pets don't live that long, so they tend to die more of diseases that come on relatively quickly. The cancer, of course, is a big one: heart disease, kidney disease, and unfortunately, I like you, I one of the saddest things for me is seeing all my patients come in and they really don't want to be there.
No.
You know, I love to see them, but they're not always that happy to see me. And one of that's a trait that I get asked so many times, that when the time comes, what do I do? You know, and in most people, like say, if they could arrange things, they would like to have their pets die at home. But since that doesn't happen, and we often have to make that decision, going to the home and actually doing the euthanasia there in their own, you know, where they're comfortable, often given a sedative first, so they just kind of naturally fall asleep without the stress of the background, the other animals, other people, the car ride, all those things. Mm-hmm. Is a really a nice way to end their life, and I've done that in a number of occasions, and it's been fulfilling for me as well, to kind of end that cycle in a really positive way.
And once our pets have died, I was talking about, you know, burying our pets in our backyard. I don't think everyone has backyards, but I've noticed now that some of my friends have spent quite a lot of money on pet cemeteries and getting a headstone. And Hank, did you bury your pet in your backyard? Or
We actually had our veterinary came out, made a house call, and took care of it at home. And that was extremely helpful, because he was had anxiety about going to the vet. And at that point in his life, he didn't need any more of that. So the veterinarian offered a cremation service. So, you know, after she put him to sleep, she took him away and had him cremated. And we've got his ashes.
So you did keep his ashes?
Yep, we do.
Interesting. Did you ever think of having him stuffed?
No.
That
just seems weird.
Well, I think that there was a documentary. We were talking about the Slow Film Festival, and there was a documentary called Furry Friends. I think that's what it's called. It was about people who had their animals taxidermied. I don't know if that's the right term, but stuffed to keep forever. Have you had people come in and do that?
You know, I think I can only remember one occasion, and it was quite a few years ago. Somebody asked about having their pet. They also do freeze drying. And having that done. And I remember doing some research, and there was nobody close that did it. I think the closest was down in the L.A. area. And I don't know if they ever followed up on it. But the idea was that you could keep taking your pet everywhere. You could put him in the car. I don't think it's a real popular idea.
I wouldn't, you know, everyone handles grief differently. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't it's not something I would do. You know, we are fine with the cremation, and it's not having them freeze-dried or stuffed is not something that I would even think about doing. But I won't put anyone down for having that thought, because, like I said, we all deal with it in different ways and want to remember our pets in different ways.
Absolutely. And I think the thing that Dr. Pollack had mentioned earlier, that things have shifted in our culture, that the way animals are in our lives has changed dramatically. I mean, 12,000 years ago, the first dogs were domesticated, and they were from wolves, and it was more of a hunting partnership, right? That the that men needed the wolves to help them be more proficient hunters, and it came time that the domesticated dogs needed the hunters to help them to survive. And so we've come a long way from that. And also, you know, when cats are domesticated, was to be ridding pests, right? To get pests out of the villages and out of the castles. And then they went on to become these sacred parts of society. But like you also said, in some cultures that we're eating animals that we would consider pets. So things have changed quite a bit in the last 20, 30 years with relationships with animals. And do you feel that this has been a healthy shift?
Oh, I do. Yeah. Do. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
From the veterinarian.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, having my dogs as outdoor dogs. You know, they're part of my family and they're there. I was fortunate recently to be given a puppy that my heart sort of belongs to long-haired dachshunds. Everybody, I think, has their ones that have sort of touched them. Mm-hmm. And she was a baby, and I'm pretty busy. I work a lot of hours, and when I'm off, I live out in the country. I have a lot of stuff to do, so I pretty much go from morning to night. And she's a baby and like to take naps. And I think when I first got her, we sat down, and she fell asleep on me. And I was thinking, you know, I don't usually do this. I don't stop. I don't just stop, relax, let her sleep, and give me time to reflect. And I really enjoyed that. It was like a new experience for me.
Like a stress reliever.
Yeah.
Almost like it was a mandatory slowdown for you so you could care for your pet.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just the most the warmest experience. I just really love that.
So we probably, if we had taken your blood pressure at the time, we would have noticed that it had gone down.
I'm sure it would have.
So we've seen this kind of change of more of a partnership with animals and people over the years, and the connection between pets. So when you're thinking about your clients that come in, and who's your patient when someone comes in your office? Is it the humans or is it the pets?
Well, I would say that, you know, ultimately we're the advocate for the pet because, you know, they can't speak for themselves. But we're in a partnership. So, you know, the client, the owner of the pet makes the ultimate choices for them. So we sort of speak from the standpoint of the pet, you know, what's going on, what they need. And then we have to talk to the people about, you know, how we do that.
So you kind of have co-clients that are going
yeah.
back and forth. So what are some of the things that people who want to adopt a pet, and someone who's listening today and said, wow, I think I need to bring an animal partner into my life. What are some of your recommendations for care, you know, for let's say dogs and cats, because there's lots of pets. Let's say dogs and cats. One, what is your recommendation for adopting? Where do you recommend? Do you say the Humane Society or the Pound? And what is the basic care that people are going to be looking at when it comes to adopting a dog first and then cats?
Well, I think first of all, you know, there's people want to start out with a puppy, but some don't. Not everybody wants to go through puppyhood.
I always adopt adult animals.
Yes. I mean, they're the hard ones because they need homes. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot different, you know, when you start that. With a baby, you really start at the basics. You have to do preventative care. You've got to vaccinate. You've got to make sure they don't have parasites. They need training. They need socializing. They need to become, you know, part of the family so that everybody can live together. Mm-hmm. With an older dog, often those things have already been accomplished. And so now, you know, some people get very old dogs. A lot of the dogs that I have come to me at you know, 13, 14 years old. They don't have much time left. So it's a whole different kind of thing. We have to find out, you know, what are their ailments, you know, and how can we help those? What do we have to prevent at, you know, 13 or 14 years old versus, you know, 2 or 3 months old? Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, true for both dogs and cats. They're just a little bit different.
So is there maintenance, like a yearly checkup, or is it more around shot schedules?
Well, for babies, they're just like kids. They go in regular shot schedules, and they're till they get through that. Babies are real good experience for young couples, even, because they're like having children. It's a practice run, you know, because they go through all the same things, except they just go a lot faster. So you get a chance to experience it without the real thing. So, they come in often. They come in about every 3 to 4 weeks for those first few months of life. And then young animals are generally pretty healthy. They don't need a lot of care. Generally, once a year is adequate. But once you start getting up into the older years, probably twice a year examinations are a good idea.
So this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I've been joined in the studio today by Dr. Stephen Pollack from VCA South County Animal Hospital. And we've been talking about mental health and pets and how things have changed in our culture over the last 20, 30, 40 years to our pets becoming members of our family. And I know that in my class at Cal Poly, we do a genogram, which is a family tree. And students are always saying, there's no place in the format for my pet. You know, we need to add this place. And that's been a change just in the last 5 years that I've been teaching this class, that every quarter students say, how do we note our pets in our genogram? And so we're even having to shift therapeutically how we identify the pets. And, you know, pet grief is a very important aspect of a lot of families' lives. And I know hospice offers pet loss counseling. And so clearly things have changed. So I think we need to also develop more responsibility in adopting our pets and understanding that it is a long time commitment, that we have changed from just throwing the pet out in the backyard and having them kind of fend for themselves, that if you're making this commitment to an animal, it is like making a commitment to having a child, that you have someone that you're responsible to. And if they do develop ailments as they age, that you might have to adjust your lifestyle to accommodate that. So, Dr. Pollack, any final thoughts you'd like to share about pets and pet ownership?
Well, I guess, you know, I have to say that I am biased about it, being an animal lover and spending my life really treating them. But I can't think of another thing that having a pet in your life can do the same kind of thing. It provides us with so much with so little in return. And I hope that more and more people will develop that bond with animals and improve their lives that way too.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come in. And I highly recommend VCA, South County Animal Hospital, has taken such good care of my family of animals and my own mental health and well-being when I've had to go in with my animals over the years. Hank, thank you for sitting in today.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Fascinating topic.
It's been a wonderful day. And continue enjoying May, which is National Pet Month. Thank you for tuning in to this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist and supporting your public radio, KCBX.